So let me tell you a little bit about me. I started wearing leather in 1975, and I'll talk more about that. But I started living leather in 1977, and this is how I got there. This is actually part one of, honestly, I could do 40 hours of this, and I'm not exaggerating. I'll explain why. I went to 12 years of Catholic school. And when it came time for me to turn 18 and I was getting kicked out of the house, I was terrified because I didn't know anything. I didn't know which way to turn a screwdriver. I had had no mentoring. I had a father that had hated me and tried to get rid of me when I was 12. And I was really not a happy man. If anything, I was a bitter, cynical, fucked up punk. I felt that I'd been lied to about sexuality, about love, about relationships, and I didn't believe anything anymore, and I didn't know what to believe. But I knew that I needed to find out. And I tried to talk to the young men that were around me of my age group, and they were not interested. They didn't know any more than I did. Well, I did the smart thing, and I started hanging around. Well, I'll get to the story. I came out as a gay man, 1975, showed up on the back of my boyfriend's motorcycle on Christmas Day. We were both in leather. We came in, handed Mom her present, said, "Merry Christmas, Mom. By the way, this is my boyfriend, Mark. He'll be sleeping with me tonight." So I didn't know how else to come out to my mom. That was not what she was expecting and not what she was liking. But I didn't have any role models except for Liberace and, you know, Charles Nelson Reilly. So I just had to make shit up as I went along. Well, I joined the Navy. I started doing a lot of drugs. Back in the 70s, it was the days before random drug testing. And so you could, you know, there were dealers in the barracks. And so it was very easy to, I was doing a lot of amphetamines at the time because I was bored, I was horny, it was the first time away from home, and all these naked men, and I didn't know how to approach them or what to do about it. I was still trying to be straight. You know, I had girlfriends in high school, but my emotions are towards men. Well, one day in the barracks, one guy offered me something that he said was the THC, the component for marijuana. It actually turned out to be PCP stepped on with smack, and I pretty much overdosed. Projectile vomiting, cherry pie all over the carpet everywhere, sick, having to constantly remind myself to breathe because I would stop breathing. And so then I'm staggering down the hallway, and there were 23 of us that had somewhat overdosed in the barracks. This was at the beginning of a long weekend, so there was like nobody watching us. And so then one guy says, "Why are you going down to the going that way?" And I said, "Because I got to take a cold shower and sober up." Well, word spread like crazy, and all of us tried to get into a shower enclosure the size for two people. And if I'd been sober, it would have been a lot more fun. But I realized that it scared me. I realized I had to stop doing drugs and that I had to figure out what the hell was really the problem. So I went to the local base shrink, who happened to be a gay man. And he says, "You're not going to change. There's a lot of good about it. It's time you started letting yourself off the hook and started enjoying being a gay man." Okay, so I thought, what do I do about that? Well, if anybody knows me, I'm a very touchy kind of guy. I like to manhandle. So the word came out very quickly in my barracks that I'm really good at giving massages. So several times a day, see people would show up at my room going, "I've got a really stiff neck." It wasn't their neck, okay? And I started getting laid a lot because, I mean, all these straight guys, well, they're away from home, they don't have access to women, they're horny, and they want to do some experimentation. And I was perfectly happy to help them out. So I'm doing lots and lots and lots of, you know, massages, which always ended with a happy ending. And then one day, a redhead showed up at my door. He lived in the room next door, and he wanted a massage. I slapped him on the ass after, and when we got to a certain point, I said, "Turn over." "Uh-uh." I said, "Come on, it's just us guys." So we turned over. He had a hard-on. I pounced on it, and we became boyfriends for the next 6 months until he shipped out. Well, our roommates were so nice that one of my roommates swapped with him so that he could spend more time with me. See, back in the 70s, we were the new civil rights movement. nobody dared to fuck with us. We had shit in the news every day about gay liberation, people marching, angry, slogans. I just celebrated my 38th Pride, San Diego Pride. In the early days, it was an angry, angry march. It wasn't a celebration. It wasn't a parade. It was a fuck you, 2, 4, 6, 8. Gay is just as good as straight. So we had a lot of issues that we were still working through, and we were pissed off, and nobody knew if it was okay to mess with us. Well, here I'm in the Navy, and I got onto a ship, and like within 2 days, this guy comes up to me. He was probably about 5'6", built like a brick shit house, very lean and very tanned and covered in tattoos and really handsome. And he comes up to me. He worked in the boiler room, you know. And I was a highfalutin electronics technician, but he comes up to me and says, "Why don't you come up topside with me? We need to talk." Okay. I had no idea who the hell he was. And so then we get up topside so we can have some privacy, and he says, "You're gay, aren't you?" And I said, "Oh, no, not the kid." And he says, "It's okay, I am." And I went, "Eh?" Because up to that point, the only gay guys that I was hanging out with were the sissy boys. They were easy to see. And they were the only ones I could spot, so I was hanging around with them, and they thought I was hilarious. Because every time I would say, "Oh, girlfriend," or "Oh, Mary," they'd just roll over laughing because I don't have that kind of nature. It's not in me. And I tried. I really tried. And it just wasn't working. Well, this guy took me to his apartment off the ship and showed me a Tom of Finland book. And I went, "That's me! Holy shit!" It was the first time in my life I discovered that men could fuck where one of them wasn't pretending to be a girl. I'd never heard of that before. It was like, holy crap, why didn't somebody tell me? So I borrowed the book and I photocopied several pages because I liked the outfits and I wanted them. Well, I had it all planned. When our ship went overseas for Westpac, where our ship would just go overseas to Asia for 6 months, then traditionally what you do is when you get to Hawaii, you buy chocolate-covered macadamias. When you get to Japan, you buy stereo equipment and you buy a Nikon camera. When you get to the Philippines, you buy mama-san and papa-san chairs that are like big baskets with pillows in them. And when you go to Hong Kong, you always have custom suits made. Well, in the mid-70s, everybody was having all these crushed velour leisure suits made. And I went to the tailor, and I showed him these photocopies, and I said, "That's what I want, Tom of Finland leather head to toe." Okay, and so then I gave him a pair of my jeans that fit just right. And I said, "You take these apart, use them as a pattern. I want it just like that." Well, so then about a week later, I came back to pick up my stuff, and they'd made a custom leather jacket for me, just the way I liked it. They made a hat. They made platform boots, like I needed platform boots, but you know, the heels were about this tall and the soles were about that big. And they were really sexy, trust me. Back in the mid-70s, they were the shit. But so then I put on the pants. I went, "What the hell? These are all baggy. I want them tight." And they said, no, too tight. We'll sprit." I said, "I don't care if they sprit. You make them tight." So they retailored them. So I'm wearing this outfit. I'm out on the town. I'm in Hong Kong. I thought, I want to go to the big tourist attraction called Tiger Balm, Balm Gardens. It has all these weird statues and stuff. I thought, that should be interesting. But I'm lost in Hong Kong. I can't read the signs. And I've got a map out, and I'm going this way and that way, trying to figure it out. I put the map down, and I realize there's about 50 little tiny Asian people looking up at me like this, like, you know, like Godzilla has arrived. And as soon as they see me looking, they scatter. And so they put the map back up and they gather again because they couldn't believe it, because with the platform boots and with the hat, I'm well over 6'10". They'd never seen that, you know. But anyway, so then I got into the ship. And again, I'll remind you, I was an angry punk. I was not only openly gay from 1976 until 79 in the Navy, I was also openly a gay leather man. I would go on and off the ship in full gear. And I made no apologies about it. I was abrasive. But so then we'd pull into port, let's say, I don't know, some Asian place, let's say Kowloon or whatever. Well, I'd go to the Navy base, and I would go to the gym. And I would work out, and I would look to see which male homosexuals were going from the workout floor to the steam room, to the locker room, and back, and back, and back. And I go, aha. So then I'd follow one of them into the steam room, and we would exchange credentials. And then I'd say, so where do the gay guys hang out when they're in port? Oh, you want to go to the Petty Officers Club on Wednesday. So, anyways. Well, so then I would go to the Petty Officers Club on Wednesday night, and there'd be the table. Let's say the Enterprise is in town. And there'd be 80 guys at several tables. And you could always tell where the gay tables were because they didn't have any hostesses sitting on anybody's laps, because there were usually these little Asian hostesses with, push-up bras that were flirting with the straight guys, but it didn't do them any good to flirt with the gay guys for tips, so they just kind of leave us alone except for, getting us drinks. But so then I'd go in full leather, and they'd scatter like rats because they were trying to be discreet, and I was anything but discreet. Well, I discovered that the best thing to do instead was to pick up lieutenant commanders and chief warrant officers and all these older men in their 40s and 50s, and they really liked me a lot, and I liked them too. And I discovered I didn't have to pay for anything. Let's say I'm in, the Philippines, and I pick up on a chief petty officer, and it's the beginning of a three-day weekend, and we head out to the countryside. And, he'd pay for the hotel, he'd pay for the meals, pay for the transportation, and I would just fuck him the whole weekend. Do the math, 20 goes into 43 more times than 43 goes into 20. But anyways, so I really had a lot of fun, but what I did at every point, is I would ask, how could I make this better? Because remember, I came from a deeply ignorant, really primitive upbringing in the Roman Catholic Church. I mean, let's face it, if any of you is Roman Catholic, the Baltimore Catechism, the book that we studied from, didn't have anything to do with the life that we're living now. And I wanted to find out how to be streetwise. So now I asked these older men, and they always were glad to tell me. And I thought, wow, I've really hit the jackpot. And so this, in the Navy, what I discovered was that things were not what I expected at all. In the mid-70s, I discovered that there is no such thing as a straight man on a ship that's been at sea for 3 months. Everybody, all those straight boys suddenly get all curly around the edges. And they want to get real friendly. And they come up to me and they grab me from behind and they, wrestle with me and stuff. And they go, meet me in the anchor room. It was where they stored the chains. I go, fuck them. And I fucked a lot of guys on that ship. And there was usually a line of guys, there'd be one guy keeping guard while everybody else is inside the anchor room. It was a very popular place. But one time on my ship, there were 1,300 guys on the ship, and the gay table usually had at least 40 guys. And we would know each other, we'd hang out with each other, it was very sociable. Well, one day, this one guy shows up, and no matter what I said, he would say something nasty and snappish and bratty in response. He'd try and overdo whatever I was saying. It's like, man, what the hell's that about? Well, after a while, I thought, I just figured that out. So then I knew he was on duty in the dental spaces that night. There's like 12 dental chairs in there in the office. I knocked on the door. He let me in. I grabbed him, threw him up against the wall, started kissing on him, started playing with him, pulled his pants down, threw him over one of the dental chairs, and fucked him. And oddly enough, he was really respectful to me from then on and followed me around like a puppy. But anyway, so what changed during that period of time? Back in the early 70s, everybody started gravitating to the large cities, to the gay neighborhoods. Okay, I'm putting scare quotes around that because nowadays we don't have quite so much gay neighborhoods. We have massive areas. I mean, here in San Diego, it's no longer just Hillcrest. Hillcrest is like 5% of the gay neighborhood. It just goes as far out there as you can imagine, but that's another story. Here, back in the, what happened is in 1967 or 66, something like that, Life magazine did a story on a leather bar. And everybody who looked at it, who had any kink in them, went, oh, there's masculine men, I'm not the only one. Holy crap, this is great. So they started moving to the big cities and forming the gayborhoods, forming the gay ghettos. Boys Town. And so then, as more and more of them moved into town, more and more cute little shops and boutiques started opening up, and more bars. Around 1979, 1980, there were 6 leather-specific bars open in San Diego. We don't have that anymore. But it was jumping. But also we had massive amounts of bathhouses. Well, the bathhouses were a major social center because all these men who've been repressed, who've been, you know, told that's sinful, that's bad, well, now they're away from folks telling them, you know, shame on you, and they were going crazy with it. And I think it was very healthy. I really do. Because people needed to liberate their dick, liberate their butt. You know, they needed to just be as sexual as they wanted to be. And it was wonderful. I mean, I used to stay, I would go up to, I mean, okay, I'm jumping ahead of myself. I was wearing leather, but my first time where I really understood, where I really got how kinky I am, is I had a boyfriend named Mark, and he was doing the asshole thing with me too, constantly sassing me, constantly provoking me. And I finally grabbed him, pulled his pants down, threw him over my knee, and started spanking him. And we both got hard-ons. And I went, whoa, 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 whoa. I had just come out as a gay man. What the hell? I'm going to have to come out as a kinkster too? And I was kind of fighting it at first, but then I thought, okay, I'm going to start learning more about this. So I started hanging out more at the leather bars. And it was a little distressing at first because everybody saw this big top in full gear and they expected me to know stuff. And I didn't know stuff. You know, they'd be saying stuff to me and it'd be like signals zinging past me and I didn't know the language. I figured it out, but, you know, hanging around with young guys, it didn't work very well for me. The young guys didn't have, like I said, didn't have much wisdom themselves. So hanging around with the older guys, like I said, it was a huge breakthrough for me. For instance, one time, I was living off the ship, you know, I was living in an apartment building in Hillcrest. It was Wednesday, I had the day off, and I was doing laundry down in the laundry room. There's this little mousy guy, really not my type at all, but he was like doing the mating dance. He really wanted to get it on with me. And I was like, oh, whatever, you know, and finally I thought, I'll throw him a thrill. I was so wrong. I was so wrong. I became his butt slave for 3 weeks because he was the first man that I ever met who knew what the fuck he was doing. See, I've got protruding buttocks. My nickname was Thunderbuns back then. And everybody wanted to fuck the, you know, the nice ass. And I hated it. I'd bite the pillow, I'd bleed, I'd cry, I'd feel bad afterwards, take me days to heal, and I just thought, what the hell am I doing this for? I just didn't like it. Well, with him, it was fucking paradise. It was ecstatic. He knew how to get me to relax, how to get me seduced. Nobody had ever done that before. They'd done what dogs do, jump on, pump, squirt, jump off. And I thought, this is my holy quest. I'm going to make sure that everybody that I play with has the same experience that I just had. And that's been my goal, and I think I've done a very good job of it, which is that I've learned how to be a really, really good top, fucking wise from him, and then by every time I would play with somebody, well, how did I get even more experience? My brothers, this is not a brag. I promise to you, this is not me bragging at you at any point during this. This is just history. This is what happened. I have had sex with over 3,000 men. Probably 99.something% of that involved me putting my dick into them. It's my nature. It's my wiring. How did I get to that point? Well, at the 1976 San Diego Pride March, I was marching along. I was with the gay youth group. And there was this very handsome man standing there in a full black business suit. Very handsome. And I said, what the hell are you standing off to the side for? Come march with us. Well, the first words out of his mouth were, do you like LSD? And I said, actually, I prefer LUST, you know, because I was not looking to do any drugs. Well, he invited me to his place. Do you know where the Park Manor Hotel is over here, 6th and Spruce? Well, if you look at the front of the building that faces the park, and the topmost balcony is a 7-room suite that he had. He was making about $400,000 a year back then in the mid-70s, and he was doing very well for himself. And I arrived for the party that day, and everybody is standing around dressed and drinking and talking and laughing. And there he is, stark naked, playing a Bösendorfer grand piano in the middle of the living room. And he spent a lot of time naked because he had a big dick. He was a shower, and he liked flopping around at everybody. Hey, there it is. But so then, when everybody left, then he had me fist him. And up to that point, I'd never even heard of fisting. And I tried it, and I went, oh, yeah, fuck, yeah, this is hot shit. What else you got? And so he started teaching me other kinky things. But remember now, okay, mid-70s, a lot of sexual athletes were very active, okay? David was on all the good party lists. When I say good party lists, I'm not talking about random raunchy people. Wealthy guys all knew each other. And they would have more upper crust type play parties where, like, say, if it was somebody's turn, then we would go up to Bel Air. And a week before the big play party, before 140 guys would show up, a crew would arrive a week beforehand with trucks and take all the exquisite furniture out, and they would put up big cotton blankets all over the walls. Why? Because somebody's stoned out of his mind, and he's staggering down the hall with his arm covered in Crisco. You don't want him bumping up against the tapestry or the upholstered walls or whatever. And then after the party was come up, would be done, then next month we would do the next one. So I got invited to a lot of these things. And being a young guy with a big dick that knew he wanted to fuck older guys, I had a lot of fun. I got invited to a lot of parties. But since I was the only one who was doing zero drugs, zero. I mean, it wasn't until about 10 years ago that I would even allow myself to have caffeine. That's how strict I've been. I didn't want any more overdoses. It just totally traumatized me. Well, so then I would go to these parties, and I was pretty fertile back then. You know, I know now in history, in historical perspective, I've always been into orgasm control of other people. And so my pleasure would be to force somebody to come without him being able to plan for it. That's always been one of my special things. Well, my pleasure was going to a big fuck party with slings and stuff like that, and I would play with the man, and within just seconds, I could, bam, make him come. Then I'd thank him, and I'd go to the next one, bam, and make it was like firing off guns. And then I'd just get tired about midnight. I'd say, okay, I'm off to sleep. Oh, but we're just getting started, man. You guys go ahead. Well, then the next morning, I would be cruel. Well, Sunday morning, I would be sadistic, because this is a party that started Friday night and went all the way to Sunday morning. And here's everybody draped over the furniture. They're completely wiped out. And I'd be saying, come on, you got to help me make breakfast. Ah, and come on, let's go. And I'd make one guy crack walnuts. I'd make another one squeeze oranges. And I'd make another one peel bananas and mash them. And, you know, all this stuff. And I'm making the other one make coffee and shit. And they're all complaining and shit. And we're making all these banana walnut waffles, omelets and stuff like that, and frittatas, and getting everybody all fed, and they were not grateful. But I was a big sadistic bastard. But so then I started going to a lot of these parties. Well, one of the things that we also did, and this is a funny story, I'll sidebar into a funny story. David Dolaheit, the man in that picture that you guys have seen, I'm sure I have it in here. I'll pass it around. But David and I, oh, actually I won't. I'll do that later. Every month, once a month, we would go up to L.A. to spend the weekend just having sex up there. We always had a sling room wherever we were, and we hosted a lot of parties in our own home, but we figured we wanted to check out some fresh meat. So once a month, we would go up early on a Friday afternoon to the 8709 up in West Hollywood, 3rd Avenue, and it was a multi-story bathhouse. Now, the bathhouses, there were so many of them that they could afford to specialize. There was one bathhouse where you went up the wooden stairs to get to the entrance. There was a spotlight above the door, and you had to lift your shirt and flex to prove that you had a six-pack before they even let you in. They could afford to be picky. Well, at the 8709, on a typical Friday night, there'd be 400 guys, and there was like no need for dividers or closed doors or anything like that. People were doing everything everywhere. I mean, it was like you wouldn't believe the amount of stuff that was going on a constant basis. Well, one particular time, there was a man, very buff, who was wearing military dog tags, military cap, and combat boots, and nothing else, who was handing out these little party invitations. And he was only handing them out to guys that he thought were particularly hot. Well, David and I got together later on that evening, because he'd go off in his direction. He was the good time that was had by all, and I was looking to top people, so we would split up and we'd get back together again to sleep. We put in our earplugs and get some sleep. We were using it as our hotel. Because it's so noisy in there because people go, in the next partition on the other side, and blasting disco music, you know, so you just couldn't sleep unless you had earplugs in. But so we got together that evening, and we realized we'd both gotten the invitation. We thought, well, the party's the next night. We're here for a good time. Why not? So we headed up into the hills of Beverly Hills and Bel Air and got to the address, went through the gate, and this place made the Beverly Hillbillies' house look like a dump. I mean, what a mansion. Big, beautiful mansion. But all the windows were dark. There was about 120-something cars on the lawn. And the reason why it was dark is because the entire basement was a third floor underground that had been entirely customized for a fuck party. They entertained a lot. So we get there, and we come in through the doors. I'm going to stand up for this portion here. And it had a rectangular floor plan, okay, divided into three rooms. Okay. So we went inside, and the first room, there were seven bunk mats, meaning mattresses covered in naga. There was macrame hanging from the ceiling holding cans of crystal. There were seven slings. There were raunchy posters all over the wall, bars and bathrooms all over the wall. There were two sets of $15,000 pair of MagnaPen planar speakers, one in each corner, playing hot music. But most impressive of all is that there were color televisions in the upper corners, in each corner, playing porn. Remember, this was about 1976-77, and the only people that had video equipment were really wealthy people, some of UMAX. They didn't have VHS back. They had paid somebody to transfer 8mm porn films on the video, and they were able to play it. First time I ever saw it, I thought, wow, that's hot. That's going to catch on. That's a going thing. So anyways, in the corner was this big guy. And he looked like a professional bodybuilder, naked, wearing nothing except for a bow tie and a smile, handing out free drinks at the bar. So everybody arrives, they get their drink, and they go to the next room. The middle room was tiled in white and brightly lit, and it was full of racks and racks of clean white fluffy towels and soap. There were shower nozzles, there were douche nozzles, there were toilets, but there were no dividers. I mean, what's the point of privacy in a fuck house, right? Well, so then the third room was the biggest one. One of the walls was about 80 feet long and covered in purple, you know, the holes with hooks for holding clamps and whips and floggers and toys, 80 feet long, and covered in toys. I mean, covered in toys. And slings all over the place. It was very dark, very spooky. And so then everybody came in, and they got their drink, and they did the tour, and they started gathering by the entrance again. And we're waiting for something to happen. The host never showed up. I don't know what the hell happened to him. Now, this was in the height of the Castro clone era. What that means is gay men, like us, who had been told that the only way that we could actually be male homosexuals is if we had to be women, we were tired of it. And when we found out that we could be male archetypes, we could be firemen, we could be policemen, we could, you know, all these different hyper-masculine types, then we started dressing the part. Well, that's where the village people came from. We weren't imitating them, they were imitating us. But so then, here it is, it's the middle of winter, and all these men are geared up. We got gear, we got leather, we got, you know, lumberjack drag, we got all this other stuff. But nobody knew each other, it was quiet. And the music starts dying down. Got real quiet. Suddenly, one guy unzips his jacket, and it was loud. And it went, oh, okay, I guess it's time. So they all start unsnapping, unzipping, and get down on the ground, pulling off the boots. But nobody's talking. In the midst of this, I'm standing there, looking around. In the midst of the silence, I said, well, where's all the women? And I could hear them swallowing their gum. Going, oh, crap. Oh, crap. Somebody please deal with this. And after about 10 seconds, I laughed and laughed, and I grabbed one guy's dick, and I started kissing on him. They just totally busted everybody up. The reason why I did it is the same reason why I do what I do these days. I'm a party starter. I'm a permission giver. I'm an initiator of fun. And I could tell that they needed an icebreaker. Well, it kind of succeeded way beyond belief because I was really popular that night. People would slap me on the ass and talk to somebody saying, save some of that for me, stud.
I'm next, you know. So it was a fun evening, but it was when I really started owning what a leader I could be.
So that's one of the fun stories. There's a lot of stories. It's very easy for me to drop into fun stories where I always win and I always look good. You know, I got a ton of those. You know, those will be part of another talk another time. That was the one I'm doing tonight. But giving the historical background, what happened is that mobility happened. When someone's living in Squawzass, Idaho, or, you know, Chicken Leg, Nebraska, and they're being pecked at because they're different, they're being tormented because they're different, or they're feeling left out because they don't want to fuck women or whatever, well, then they hear that there's a bunch of hot bars in, you know, Atlanta or whatever. Basically, they pick a coast and they move. And that is my opinion why the red states are getting redder and the blue states are getting bigger. This part of San Diego is a refugee camp. See, back in the old days, Hillcrest used to be known as the gay 90s, because in order to live there, you had to be either gay or 90. Because all the old original owners of all those little bungalows were dying off, and gay couples were moving in and tarting up the place, making it, you know, gentrified. You know, they plant flowers in their yard, well, it made everybody else go, we need them in our yard too. So it started raising the property values and raising the property values. Well, the problem was that more male couples would get together and they'd say, we want to buy a house, and they couldn't afford it in Hillcrest anymore. So they'd head for North Park or University Heights or Normal Heights or Talmadge or Kensington or Burlingame or, you know, on and on and on. Well, 20-something years ago, this is a sidebar, I moved into our house in 1993. Yeah, so it's been a while. And as we're moving boxes, I saw a guy over the back fence. That's a gay man that I know, another man. So I go up and, hi, oh, it's nice to know that there's others in the neighborhood. He says, oh, you got to be kidding. He says, you know, what about these folks and these folks and these folks? So I said, really? Well, perhaps I should organize a neighborhood party. So then I thought, I'll invite a few. Well, that's not how it turned out. I got on my bicycle on a Saturday morning. This was in the days when there were lots of rainbow flags and lots of pink triangle bumper stickers and stuff like that. It was easy to spot them. So I went up and down every single street in Normal Heights. And every time I would see a rainbow flag or a pink triangle or a lambda, which were still very popular by that time, I'd go up and I'd knock on the door. Somebody cracked the door open. Yes. I mean, a little bit of me goes a long way, and there's a lot of me, okay? And there's this apparition on the front porch, and I say, is that your red Toyota out in front? Yes. I say, well, I saw the rainbow bumper sticker, and I have, you know, it's covered in rainbow flags. I say, I've got a party invitation for the gay neighbors. Okay. Thank you. Well, they didn't know what to think about that. Nobody had ever done it before. The first year, we only had 25 households. The next year, word got around. We had over 220 households that participated in the neighborhood party. Well, in celebration of that, I had made a map of Normal Heights, just Normal Heights, not Hillcrest, not any other neighborhood, and printed out big on foam core and made these little rainbow flag pushpins that people could put where they lived. I discovered that every single block had a minimum of two or three gay or lesbian households. Every block. Well, then I started talking to some of the real estate, gay real estate agents for different neighborhoods, and they said, oh yeah, that's true here too. So what happened is that Hillcrest still has a reputation of being the gay neighborhood, but honestly, it just expands outward, all the way from Highway 5, way the fuck out to Lakeside. I mean, Lakeside is so full of lesbians. And, you know, and it used to be full of rednecks. Well, basically, everybody's taking over, so that we don't have that same problem anymore. So again, people are here because they want to get the fuck away from closed-minded people. And mobility has made all the difference. The problem is that it has become a brain drain, so that people who would normally be champions and creative people, they don't want to live in Tuscaloosa, so they're gone. So it makes it very difficult to protect the people who remain behind. And so the bigots get more bold. But that's the sidebar. Moving on. Living in gay ghettos back in the 70s was very much of a swing of the pendulum. We were tired of hanging around with straight people. We didn't want them anymore. We thought they were a bunch of assholes. We wanted to be around nothing but gay people. Well, Hillcrest, you could do that, but especially West Hollywood. West Hollywood was an entity unto itself. I mean, it was the first, I mean, they broke off from L.A., they formed their own thing. They had the first gay mayor, who was a porn actor, and really good looking. And I've seen him fucking live. But moving on, but West Hollywood, you could, I mean, I lived there for a while, and you could go weeks without seeing a heterosexual person. I mean, you could go to the local drugstore, and as you open the door to go in, there's the magazine rack, and it's all full of Blue Boy and, you know, Mandate and all that, and they're not covering the covers. I mean, it's just like guys everywhere. Well, people went crazy bringing stuff to us, you know, saying, hey, this is a great market. So then they're, you know, like, bathhouses like you wouldn't believe, but also the bars were particularly, there were so many of them, but they could specialize. Like one time I went to, I think it was called the Palladium up in L.A. I wanted to dance. And so then the current Mr. Universe was there with his boyfriend. And, you know, I was nice enough to him, but I'm not a star fucker. I mean, I wasn't, like, trying to get in his pants or anything. But so then we're all dancing together, and suddenly I had to leave the room, leave the building, because they had a piping system up in the ceiling that at the right moment they would release poppers as a mist onto the crowd. And I don't know about you guys, but it just totally disorients me. It does not do anything good for me, and I just had to leave. We had a lot of stuff that was very, very, very gay-specific that had never been happening before. When we would go up to San Francisco for the parties, but we would also spend some time at some of the big bathhouses up there, we stayed at a particular hotel called the Anxious Arms. Okay, this was a Victorian-era hotel, and it was very primitive. You know, they had these little tiny rooms, you know, no fans, no ventilation, you know, just could open the window, that's it, and one bathroom at the end of the hall, you know, and very rickety wood building. But so then, I remember one time, and this is really off topic, but I have to tell the story, one of the most bizarre experiences of my life was at the Anxious Arms. It was a hot, muggy summer night, and all of us had our doors open and our windows open as far as we could. And we're laying naked on top of the sheets and just sweating like pigs. Well, in the middle of the night, I woke up with the most horrifying feeling that the cat who lived there had jumped up between my legs and was nursing on my scrotum. To this day, it's like when, I mean, I cannot express, when with the tongue, the little sandpaper tongue and the needle claws, I mean, that cat got flying lessons. But we would spend so much time in the bathhouses that I've been to parties where, I mean, it was common to have 150 people, 150 men. It was common for, you know, I mean, I would fist guys up to here. You know what's interesting? Just, you know, quick sidebar. The guys who can take my arm, this big honking piece of meat up to the shoulder, is always the tall, skinny guys with the big dicks, the really big dicks. Where are you putting that, dude? But for some reason, those are the ones that can always take it. Unfortunately, those are the ones whose ribs I break. Why am I saying that? Not from the inside, despite what you're thinking. But if I pick somebody up, I have to be really careful with the tall, skinny guys putting them into the sling, because if I just pick them up and throw them, I'll break the rib. And then nobody will come within 10 feet of me the rest of the evening. I don't want to do that. But what else? I used to do things at fisting parties where I was still learning how to be a dominant, how to be a really effective dominant. And I would do things like, people would be really scared of this big fist. It doesn't collapse well. But so then I'd be working on them, and I'd be working on them, and I'd be working on them, and I'd have other men coaching me on how to do it right and all that, so they were making sure I wasn't damaging them or anything. But the guy would get really, you know, he'd be like really panicked, and I'd say, well, it's okay, take a break. Huh, okay, break's over. Or or I would send one guy downstairs to bring up the dictionary and read the definition of implacable, unstoppable, it would really fuck with the guy's mind, but, you know, he'd be really relieved when I finally would pop it. But so then we did a lot of flogging. I mean, I've been doing flogging forever. I mean, you guys, if you know me at all, I do the flogging thing, and I'm very good at it. Well, I learned from the best guys in the business. The first time it happened, though, I was still not really part of the community yet. But I went to a exploratorium type thing, and this one guy was demonstrating flogging. Well, I grew up in an abusive household, and I got beaten a lot as a child, so I was pretty certain the flogging was like that. And so then when the guy was talking about it and demonstrating it, he said, so who here would like to try it? My hand went up, and I looked up, and I went, what the hell's that doing there? But then I thought, okay, fucker, show me what you got. You know, I've taken worse than you. He started doing it, and I thought, this is what I'm afraid of? Holy crap, I could fall asleep with him doing this. This is nice. What the hell? It totally blew my mind, and I thought, he was doing such a great job, and I was so happy afterwards. I thought, this is my holy duty. I'm going to be doing that. I've been flogging since 1977. And I've been doing a lot of stuff, but mostly the stuff that I learned back then. That's why I'm still really not that good at, say, bondage or sounds or... I mean, there's a lot of stuff now that they didn't have back then. I mean, there was not a lot of rubber fetish back then. They didn't have stores selling latex gear back then. They didn't have puppy play at all back then. It didn't exist. They didn't have sounding. They didn't have a lot of stuff. The stuff that we did was just basically the same things over and over and over again. And it worked. But the problem that I had with the gay ghettos, all over the place, the problem that I had with the gay ghettos is that I knew that it was a fantasy hideaway, but sooner or later I had to come back to life. Because treating heterosexual people as bad things was just reverse bigotry. And that wasn't any answer, and I knew that. And I knew that I needed to start stepping out into the world again. I needed to, you know, get away from the ghetto, because it was like hiding your head in the sand. I mean, it was fun, but there were a lot of limitations. For instance, I was part of, you know, a elite, A-list type group. And I got real sick of that. I got really, really sick of that. It's like walking a tightrope every day. Because if you do something wrong, you get pecked at. You know, you get, you know, thrown out of the group or whatever. And I got tired of being constantly careful of what I said and what I did. And what really tore it for me was one day I showed up for brunch wearing shorts, flip-flops, and a Hawaiian shirt. And everybody said, no, you got to go home and get back into leather. I don't like you like this. And I said, that's not really your choice. You know, I'm off duty today. Leave it alone. But I was part of an extended leather family of about 40 men. And all different ages, all different, you know, some were the sons, some were the brothers, some were the nephews, some were the, you know, but we all were part of a big extended family group. And we had each other's back. Fetishman San Diego, this group here, is based upon what I treasure most about the past, the memories that stick with me the most. So what I haven't been telling you guys about is what it was that I needed and that what I got back in those days. See, it's all very easy to get sex. There it is. It's all over the place. But being able to find connection with each other, finding male intimacy. Some of the best memories I have from those days had nothing to do with sex. It had to do with us being in a puppy pile in front of the fireplace and just talking and just gently caressing and loving each other. Because that is what I needed more than anything else. It's nice to attract somebody, but how do you retain them? And that's always been the conundrum for us gay men. You know, that we know how to attract somebody, but bonding with each other as brothers, bonding with each other in between the generations is so crucial for us. And I got a big taste of that. For instance, when I was with David, is it break time?
Yeah.
Okay, so how do we feel about break?
Let's take two.
All right, let's do it.
Yeah.
Oh, donation.
Papa Tony.
That's me. There's... Honestly, gentlemen, there's enough material for about 40 hours worth of, talk, but let's pause for a moment and let's go to questions and answers. So, does anybody have any questions for me at all? Any thoughts, any observations?
I got one. What's the biggest thing that has changed from the old days to now?
No bad houses.
What'd you say?
No bad houses.
More condoms.
Yeah.
No,
yeah, there's a lot fewer bars and bathhouses, that's for sure, but I think the number one thing that changed, which I have been working for decades to fix, was the loss of connection between the generations. Well, that's the topic for next week. I'll be talking privately, you know, not here, where I'll be talking about when things went really bad. But to answer your question, we had a lot more tribal behavior, where we took responsibility for each other's well-being, where we wanted to make sure that the young guys got what they needed. Not just sex. Sex was great. Yay, I vote for that. I recommend it strongly. But also for the wisdom that people were willing to share. It was common to have loving uncles. It was common to have mentors. It was young man's birthright to have a whole shitload of men that cared deeply about his well-being so he could thrive, so that he would get the love that he needed, and he could stand tall and puff out his chest a little bit more and wag his tail because he's around men that he wants to be someday. And that went away when everybody died. And that's, like I said, that's next week's topic. But that is why I've been working so hard to create things like San Diego League of Gentlemen and before this, and then Fetish Men in San Diego, to build that culture again, where we have that connectedness, where we can take it for granted, where it becomes like the air that we breathe, you know, where, of course, it's this way. I want to bring more elders back, if I can find them. People who were back in those days and who know stuff and who are willing to share it. It's been really hard to find. It's been very, very hard to find, because those who gave all during the bad years disappeared from us. They went into the little bomb shelters in suburbia and said, okay, I'm done. I don't want to do anymore. I don't want to invest anymore. I'm done. And that is a huge loss, because two new generations have risen now that have not had the experience of having large crowds of loving uncles that care about them. What changed was the chasm between the generations. On one side, you know, old guys getting called trolls. Who invited the trolls? They're not young and hot and sexy and in the game anymore, so they have no further value. Why are they still on this earth? Next lifetime. Okay? Or those kids over there. You know, we'll listen to them when they're 30 years older. You know, we'll you know, they're just a bunch of empty little chippies. You know, they got nothing to add. And that distance between the generations, that bigotry, that bias, that presupposition about how we are, is so bad for us as males. We need male space. We need tribalism. We need traditions. We need to help each other get to our next level. And so that's the reason why this was created. So we support each other. Because in the absence of large amounts of mentors, these men's discussions are designed to help us learn from each other. Information shared is wisdom multiplied. And that's why things have had to change, because we've needed that intimacy, that male intimacy that we crave so much. So thank you for letting me editorialize. That's the next. Yes?
And a quick endorsement on that. That's very true. I can remember in the early 80s, I was John Travolta, Saturday Night Fever, you know, the polyester pants, the whole thing. And I went with some friends to The Hole, which was a leather bar at the time. And remember on Sundays they had the chicken box lunch and all that kind of stuff. Uh-huh. And it was full of leather men, mm-hmm. full of them. And I remember, I don't know his name now. I don't have as good a memory as Papa Tony does. But I remember this big leather man doing this to me. And I'm looking at him like, you know, screw you. And so I went over and talked to him. He said, that is not you. He says, I want to see you here next Sunday, black boots, blue jeans, and a white t-shirt, boy. And I was 23. You know, and I looked at this big leather cow and said, you're right, you know. And I walked off. And the following Sunday, I was there in black boots, blue jeans, and a white t-shirt. And that was my intro to that. And he was always there for me. He, you know, he introduced me to the leather masters and the sirs and the daddies and stuff like that, and they all, you know, they all raised me, so to speak. And like I told him earlier too, when he's talking about the guy with the piano, I used to go over there on Sundays and hang out with this guy listening to play his piano. So, you know, there you did meet people. So, mm-hmm. so but yeah, you had a lot of mentors back then that would take the young guys, and it wasn't all about sex. Yeah, we did, but that's not what it was about.
Mm-hmm.
And they raised you.
Mm-hmm. And not just daddies and boys. Again, getting back to elders. I was extremely fortunate. This is one of the biggest blessings in my life, in my own history. David Dolehite, the man that I was with for 2.5 years, he got invited to pool parties up in Valley Center and, you know, old Highway 395, that area there, all the macadamia and avocado ranches up there. Probably 40 of them were owned by elderly male couples. And I would hang out with Clark and Joseph, who'd been together 52 years before Clark died. Or I would hang out with all these men who'd been together 48 years, 42 years, 39 years. Up to that point, I didn't know they fucking existed. I had no idea that it was even possible to have a relationship that long. It was totally mind-blowing for me. Well, the first pool party I went to did not go well, and I was the problem. Because here I am, 20, 21, and I'm used to people pursuing me. I was going to the gym 6 days a week, and, you know, I was really into hanging out with buff guys, and, you know, I was really starting to hang out with the A-list crowd. Well, I go to this pool party, and here's all these naked, old, wrinkly guys, and it's like, ew, leave me alone. You know, I didn't see any point to them. And so then pretty soon in the pool, I'm the only one wearing a bathing suit, and they all start gathering around me to try and get my shorts off. And I, oh, fuck you, and I jump out of the pool, and I run into the house, and I run into the bathroom, and close and lock the door. A few moments later, tap, 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 it's Clark. He says, can we talk? I said, sure. He says, what's going on? He says, I said, these guys are trying to have sex with me. I feel abused. I feel raped. He says, you are so wrong. He says, these guys are not trying to have sex with you. They're trying to get you to calm down because you've been really tight-ass the whole time and you're bringing down the vibe of the party. This is for fun. He said, these guys want to be your loving grandpas. They want to like you. They're trying to get you to relax. I went, oh, okay. I went back out there and after a while I apologized and they became my best friends and they all took really good care of me. They were constantly helping with different stuff, giving me coaching. They were delighted that there was this young man that would listen to them. And it was such a blessing in my life. And I really miss that. You know, I mean, it was one of the nicest experiences I've had because they taught me how to have long-term relationships. I mean, I really give them credit for the fact that I've just celebrated my 24th anniversary with my husband, Dennis. And to me, knowing how to have long-term male-male relationships was a revelation because they sure the fuck didn't teach that in sixth grade. You know? They put us on a different track. You know, the rhetorical question I'm always asking over and over again is, you know, how many men here, raise your hand, went to the prom, any prom? And keep your hand up if it really had anything to do with how your life is lived now. Yeah. And wouldn't it be great if they actually taught stuff that we need to know back then, but that's a whole different concept. I predict the day will come. But in the meantime, see, there was all sorts of fun stories I want to share with you, and my mind is going a little bit blank. Somebody prompt me with a question. Yes.
Well, I came to San Diego in 83 with the Navy, and one of the first bars I went into, well, the Bronx Rail and some of the little neighborhood bars, I liked the dark little ones that were fun, but I happened to wander into the Bulk. Mm-hmm. Which is the Caswell.
Right? Oh, yeah.
And Levi is shorter than this, and you know, with the cutoffs.
Yeah. Daisy Dukes.
And you're right, the leather boots. And they dance, and that looked like fun. That kind of sold me on leather, because it was a Bulk, and that was a leather bar.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I went to the whole first thing because I got a hold of that off limits. Maybe off limits.
Yeah,
that's probably where I want to go. Where I'm not supposed to go. So I
and it was always on there. Off limits. The bathroom, walking to Fourth Avenue Bath was always on the off limits.
What would happen if you got caught going?
They said shore patrol or investigators would be there. They just try to scare you. Not a whole lot. If you behave yourself, they really can't. There's so many bases, they don't know who's in the Navy and who's not. They can kind of tell the haircuts and the young guys. I guess the question maybe is that was a fun dance bar for leather, and there isn't as many. many, but the bathhouses have gone away, and totally understand. I thought they would have gone away right after the AIDS, HIV, and all that, but they stick around. But Europe has a lot of black room, dark back rooms,
yes.
Bars and stuff. I don't know if the U.S. ever had that, and there's a few, but it's never got real frisky yet. Bars.
Well, certain bars on certain nights do get frisky.
Yeah.
Right.
It depends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even here in San Diego, yeah.
But that's kind of not as big as in Europe.
Yeah, but see, the point that I want to make about the whole backroom thing in Europe and Britain and all the rest of that stuff is that that's all they fucking have. Meaning they have no community. They have no clubs that have to do with brotherhood. It's all about raunch, 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 piss, 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 you know, pig, 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 fuck, fuck, fuck. And they don't have connectedness with each other. And they grieve. How do I know? They tell me. And, you know, I get real judgmental about it. Because treating each other like pieces of meat is not a healthy thing. I mean, it's fun when it's there, but it's not as the only thing on the menu. But that's me editorializing. So anyway, so any other questions, any thoughts? Yes?
How do you think being a male and being a stand-up man, which is kind of what we're talking about here, being able to wear our masculinity with pride, how do you think that has changed from when you were in 1975?
Yeah.
Through the backlash of that to where we are now. How do you think that's changed?
It's like the swing of a pendulum. As I said, for decades, the only thing, I mean, how many people have heard of the, what is it, the Lavender, damn it, I'm sorry, Vito Russo did a book that became a movie about the celluloid closet, that's
celluloid
it.
Closet.
Talking about how the Catholic League, you know, the Hayes Office, forced everybody starting in the 1930s to only portray gay people in a tragic and usually deadly way, where we always came to a bad end. And, you know, the moral of the story is, if you're a faggot, then you get made fun of or killed. And it just movie after movie after movie after movie, and that ended around 1970 when the Hayes Office went under. And somewhere around there. And we went from being treated like shit in movies. What really changed it was the movie Cruising. The movie Cruising was a horror movie about Leathermen. And every time that the heterosexual protagonists were there, there's violins playing, cellos and stuff, and it's all very nice, bright, sunshiny light. But every time you're in a leather bar, it's nightmare, purple and green lighting, and powerful, really awful music, and, you know, people being stabbed vividly, and, you know, it's a nightmare thing. Well, at first, they had gotten permission from all of the leather bars up in New York to film there, but then when people started figuring out what the script is about, then people started protesting and doing shit like standing on building roofs and shining big mirrors all over stuff to spoil the shot. You know, to shine light on stuff, to fuck it up, because they didn't want it to happen. And there was huge protests. I remember when me and my crew showed up at the movie theater to watch the movie, we left halfway through and loudly complained about the movie, saying that this is fucked up. People making fun and throwing shit at us as we were leaving in full leather. But it scared people in the movie industry. And within 2 years, we had Victor Victoria, the Front Runner? I don't remember. Personal Best, I think it was, and Making Love. They were saying, we're sorry, we're sorry, we're sorry. We're going to try and portray a more and more positive light. They stopped doing quite so many drag jokes. They stopped doing quite so many sissy jokes and shit like that, because suddenly they realized that there's this large amount of people who really give a shit about being treated as males, as opposed to, you know, third gender or anything like that. That they're, you know, and yes, there's people for that. God bless them. And those of us who are, you know, hypermasculine by nature, we deserve to be heard too, and we deserve not to be made fun of. And so, as far as a man, as far as gay males, like I said, the pendulum swung from, like, if you look at any Tom of Finland book, you look at his early art, it's almost all sissy boys in his art. And then he's really got into his own, starting to portray more masculine archetypes, And that sold like crazy, and then he went completely into that. And that's, you know, what he's most known for. But some of his stuff was really Nelly in the early days, because that's what the culture said he should be doing. Well, what happened with us, with Gay Leathermen, first of all, they were part of motorcycle groups back in the, you know, early 50s and onward, because nothing better than a motorcycle, because if you're doing something in town, you could get busted. You know, the police could raid and you'd go into prison. But if you're on a motorcycle, you and your crew go way out in the countryside, way out in the woods where nobody else can get to, and you fuck and you suck and you fist and you flog and you do all this crazy shit and piss on each other. And there's nobody, you know, for 20 miles around you. So that's why they did a lot of motorcycle club stuff in the early days. Well, that's a very masculine archetype. They were basing it upon, what was that Marlon Brando movie? The Wild Ones, yes. They thought, that's us. That's the direction we're going to go. And there's a lot of stuff that was tying in with that historically that I don't have the facts with me. But a lot more people started keying into that whole leather gear type thing. You know, and they had specific things that they did. Now, this is me opinionating. This is the part a lot of people are really going to hate hearing from me out there in listening land. But I had no experience with the bullshit that they call old guard now. None. Where somebody says, oh, no, no, there's only one way to do it. You should never buy your own leather. You have to earn every piece. I promise you, brothers, I never had any experience of that. I really didn't. You know those people, those oldie guardy people that say, oh, you must approach me a certain way or else I shall be, you know, insulted. We didn't have it. Those people were called assholes, okay, back in my day. And so then what happened is that people started writing books about it because in their experience, then these protocols were very important. And God bless them. There's a need for that. I say go for it. But it is not the only thing. What I'm saying is that the guys who wrote the books, those books became the new Bible. And everybody started saying, oh, well, of course it was always that way. It wasn't. Mm-hmm. I was there. I was in the middle of it. I was right in the middle of it. I was in the midst of all of that shit. And we didn't have all that hardcore stick-up-the-ass protocol crap. You know, there might have been some in between one guy and another guy, but it wasn't part of the larger culture. It was very much like what we have here. And so when somebody starts telling you, oh, there's only one possible way to be, you say, thank you for sharing. And then you just move on because they don't understand that they fetishize something that is a recent development. Because technically, I mean, I'm pretty old guard, you know, if you think about my history. I mean, I've lived like five lifetimes, gentlemen. But I have to tell you, I'm not a big fan of old guard because it's mostly used as a stick to beat other people with, which is that I'm old guard and you never shall be. I'm a really bad guest at an old guard workshop, and I know I'm going off to the side here, but it's part of it. Because I'll chew them out. There'll be a panel of old guard people, and it's like looking at a bunch of stuffed raccoons in a cage, and I mean in a display case covered in dust, because they haven't changed in forever. They're not interested in introducing anybody else to the culture that they say, oh, we're the perfect examples of. And they don't give the second half of the communication. First half is, we are old guard. Second half has to be, and every one of you is important and part of our history too, and we claim you as part of our tribe. And if they don't say that, they're just a bunch of jerks sitting behind a table. I have a strong opinion about that, because if there is no warmth, if there is no invitation, if there is no grace in it, what good are they? So that's my opinion. Yes?
A follow-up question then. Because I've read some of the books you're referring to, and yes, they all go back to say that this leather fetish started after World War II.
Right.
Was based and rooted in
military
culture,
military
hierarchy,
right,
all of that. So you're saying that that wasn't really part of what you experienced?
What I experienced, yes. In my experience, if there was that going on, they weren't hanging around near me. What I'm saying is that, I mean, I was very connected. I mean, hyper connected. On a typical weekend, every weekend, as I said, every home that I was in had a sling room. And we would have, you know, a whole room set aside with, you know, St. Andrew's Cross. We'd have stockades. We'd have all sorts of shit. And we had everybody. I mean, you name the major porn actors of the day. You know, Al Parker, Richard Hatch. Not Richard Hatch. That's from Survivor. Richard, I forget. Who are the guys from the Joe Gage film?
Richard Locke.
He was one of my best friends. I've got pictures with me of his ranch up in Palm Springs. He lived in a dome. But, you know, and Al Parker practically lived out of his van. But, you know, I was constant fuck buddies with these guys, and I knew everybody. I was connected with everybody. That's not a brag. So I was part of the culture like you wouldn't believe. I would go to the big parties, and I was so connected, and I didn't see all this protocol crap. It just seems kind of annoying to me that everybody keeps saying, well, there's only one possible way. It's like, I'm not that inflexible about it. So anyways. Yes, please.
Well, I had a request. I mean, you can mention it here, but if you, I know that, especially since we have quite a few newer folks here tonight, and you have your list of books that you think are great books.
Oh, yeah.
For people that are just coming into the community.
Yes.
If you wouldn't mind either linking to or reposting that for us on the Facebook page or on your blog, and then, you know, sending that over so that way
that's fine.
We can get that out to everybody.
That sounds good. What I would also add to that is that we have a huge resource that I need to remind everybody of, is that we have the audio and text archives for Fetishmen in San Diego. We've recorded a large number of these events, of these discussions, and posted them online. On a particular topic, and you listen to it, and everybody, you know, and people are giving their input, their feedback, it's very educational. If we post it online, and I use Google Analytics, and I can tell, within about 8 hours, it'll be downloaded 800 times. In China, in Dubai, in Germany, and Japan, and these people are desperate to hear these kind of discussions because they don't have it in their town. And they want to be a fly on the wall, if nothing else, so that they can get a sense of what it's like to be around a bunch of congenial men who get along well. And so then, you know, I'll have to post that so that you guys are reminded that we do have massive archives of things that we've discussed and things that have been written in the past. You know, it's a good thing to catch up with the culture of the group. That's why we do it.
A lot of it's really fun to listen to. It's, you know, it's not just dry. You know, there's a lot of interesting topics and, you know, a lot of laughter and things too involved in that. So it's not like you're listening to a bunch of seminar tapes from some guy who had a late night infomercial.
Yeah. Uh-oh. I think I've been talking too much tonight. Yes.
So if I kind of summarize where we were from what you said, kind of went from recognizing our sexuality and being comfortable with it, escaping to the cities,
yes,
then creating a brotherhood in those cities, expanding our civil rights, mm-hmm, fighting a disease,
yep,
just taking it forward, mm-hmm, fighting for equal rights in marriage, dealing with being accepted and being dispersed because we don't have a common cause.
Yep.
What is our challenge now?
I think we could spend a good 5 hours talking about that.
But there are, well, let me say it this way. There's some that would say we're finished. No. We did it all. So yeah. I'm playing devil's advocate. We're done. We got a gay marriage. We're done. Why is there even gay pride? Why do we have that? We're done.
Go ahead, John.
So that's why, that, and I hear that.
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the things that comes to mind for me is just the fact that the whole heteronormativity thing, where we have to, oh, okay, well, we're going to get gay marriage. Well, that instantly means that every gay person, the gay lesbian person out there, is going to pair up with one other person, and that's going to be it, and that's going to be the way it works for everybody. But that's, you know, that everyone's just going to be this cute little couple, and they're going to have their little Asian baby and their little African baby,
yeah,
and push them in the stroller, and, you know, that's what we're going to do. And, you know, I think that's one of the things that we still have to overcome. I think definitely with the leather and fetish community, we've come a long way, but there is still a lot of negative pushback against us in various places. San Diego, we're accepted very well, but that's not the same if you go across the country. We're very lucky on the West Coast. You know, all the coastal cities are that way. So there's still things like that that are, you know, and people will be able to name many other things as well. But there's still some things like that that are really important.
Please.
How many of you guys have encountered this at the gym? Oh, God, put a towel around it. because you're walking around the gym, you've got your towel over your shoulder, you're going to the shower, and someone is offended because you're walking around naked. You can't be naked in a group of men without having that some way sexualized by someone else. We need to be able, that's why we still need to go forward, because we still need to be able to be proud and own our bodies and own ourselves and not have to worry about what this person over here is thinking and how insecure they are.
Right.
I don't wear a towel at the gym because I won't promote body shame.
Yes,
I'm not
you.
Out there, I'm not, you know, I'm a grower, not a shower, so I'm not out there trying to flash everybody, but it's about body shame.
Yes.
It's about, you know, really going outside that closet.
So
and being able to project that.
Let me get one thing and I'll get you. Okay, I'm going to start out funny and then I'm going to make my big point. Okay. I think we've all seen how gay men can set the fashion many times. The whole disco thing, that was us. When I went to the guys on my ship were saying, you've got to see Saturday Night Fever. Oh my God, it's the best dancing ever in history. So I went. I sat there and I just sneered through the whole movie. That's the dancing? Because at that time, I was hanging around with a group of guys where we were in competitive dancing. And we all did freeform, and we were fucking awesome. And we could make shit up on the moment that was 40 times better than what John Travolta was jerkily doing, you know, rigid moves. And we just, get over yourself, you know. But I remember one time, see, it was very popular back in the mid-70s for men to have short hair, but a little pigtail right here at the back, in the middle at the back. And I saw a heterosexual male friend of mine. I said, you know what that means, right? He says, no. What does it mean? Stand up. And so I said, look, I wrap my finger around it, wrap it around my finger, and then I fuck you in the ass. It was gone the next day. And I remember one time I was on the ship, and we were getting ready to go out. It was a Saturday night. And this little muscular Latino guy, and he was ready to, I mean, he was wearing tight, low-cut jeans, he was wearing combat boots, he was wearing a white t-shirt, nice and tight, with the sleeves rolled up, and he very carefully put a red bandana in his right back pocket. I said, you do know what that means, don't you? He says, it means something? I said, why are you wearing it? And he says, well, because all the fashionable guys are wearing them. I said, oh. And so he said, so what does it mean? I said, it means fist fucking. And he says, you mean like this? I said, yeah, like that, you know, stroking on his dick. You know, I just didn't want to explain it. I didn't want to draw a diagrams, okay? That still extends into the present. See, this is news. This is news I'm bringing to my brothers now. I have been out in the wilderness intentionally for a few months now. I've been learning and growing. I've been finding out what's really the case. What is happening is that we are setting the tone, the pace, and the plan for everybody else. Because, think about it, as males, we're hypermasculine in the things that we do. But we have found how to be tender and vulnerable too. We have found the balance in our lives. When it's time to turn up the heat, we can do it. And then when it's time to be sweet and giggle like little girls and while we tickle and cuddle in bed before we get to the good stuff again, that we can have the full balance. The heterosexual male kinksters out there are desperate to learn this. They're hungry for this. I mentor a lot of them. The heterosexual female kinksters are anxious to learn how to do more of this or that or whatever. They're starved for role models. But see, what makes all of us in the kink community really the future is that if you go to an event, any event, and someone comes up to you and says, I'm Boy Gerald. Well, you don't say, well, look at you. You're 62 years old. You're no boy. We don't argue with them. We say, oh, tell me some more about yourself. We accept them the way that they present themselves as they are. Cool. I vote for that. No problem. The day is coming, I predict, my brothers, that off there in, you know, some tiny little place in Alabama, someone shows up and they're different. Then they'll be celebrated. That day is coming because we are at the tip of the spear, gentlemen. We're the ones who are setting the tone for the larger part of our culture. We don't want body shame because we're up to here with it and we're done. we're honest enough to say, you know, we see it all the time on the internet. We know what each other's wingdings and hoo-ha's and Razzies look like, so why are we still pretending like we don't have them? Let's be grown-ups here and have that conversation and quit pretending like it's 1948. Because we have been bold enough to step beyond what we've been taught and say, what else is there? I'm ready to find out what's true, what works now. And that I promise you, we really truly are setting the tone for a lot of people all over the place that want to be us. So thank you for letting me share that. John?
Well, I just had a question for you about bathhouses from before.
Yes.
Because I find it the most amusing thing when I go up to Midtown Spa up in Los Angeles and quite often for the bear night that they do and everything. And there's a bunch of men walking around with towels tied around their waists. Mm-hmm. And I'm the only one with my towel slung over my shoulder because
right.
I don't understand why, if we're all there for the same thing, why are we all covering everything up?
Yeah.
And was it always that way, or is this like a newer...
No. There's always been men. There's always men who, I mean, let's face it, as males, we're expected to perform, we're supposed to know stuff, like I was saying earlier with the new guys, that we're all supposed to know stuff. We're supposed to be fully fledged males, like it's supposed to be built into our Y chromosome. The fact of the matter is we're insecure about our dicks, we're insecure about our looks, we're insecure about, you know, we've been rejected for one stupid reason or another, so we've got all sorts of noise in our heads. So the towel can be the fig leaf. It can also be a way of keeping people at a distance because you're still kind of shy and unsure, and you don't, or you're really picky, and you don't want anybody going after you thinking that, you know, a dick is available. Now, I have to admit that I have an inhibition. You guys will not usually see me being shirtless in public. Not because I don't like the way I look, but because I'm 6'5", and I'm exactly the right height for a drunk to lean over and bite my nipple hard. And I fucking hate it. And it's happened so many times in my life.
I only did that once.
Oh, but see, so there's that, you know, that, you know, worried that if, like, okay, if I'm an assless chaps, 100% of the time, somebody will come up behind me and try and spank me. Or if I have a paddle in the side of my boot. By the way, the reason, as I've said many times before, the reason why I store a paddle in the side of my boot so that if I'm ever stuck up Shit Creek, I have a paddle. But, yeah. Yes, good joke, but even big. But see, the reason why I have to, I mean, what I notice is when I'm out in public, let's say out in, you know, let's see, Hillcrest, and I'm standing there talking to somebody and I've got the paddle in my boot, some little Nelly boy will grab it out of my boot and say, am I supposed to spank you now? And I'll say, you're welcome to try. And usually the slave will say, you might not want to try that. Might not be a good idea. But, you know, that might be part of the whole towel thing too, is that just trying to set the parameters so that the only time it comes off is when you're with the object of your desire. There's that.
But maybe you should say, no, I'm supposed to spank you now. And a bad boy tries to do my paddle.
Yeah. My favorite way of saying it is that, yes, you know, if you were looking to be paddled, I can do that, but you will have to pay like everybody else. So you were saying, yes, okay, first you, then you.
Yeah, I've probably been around longer than anybody in here. Yeah. I've been to my first gay bathhouse was in 1969. I've been to bathhouses in Manhattan,
yep,
in the 70s, and I lived in Atlanta for my adult life, and I have not changed one teeny little iota from 1970 until yesterday. It's the same.
Yeah.
And I've been there. At least, you know, I've not been in the whole world of bathhouses. But they're all people walk around in the towels. They still have the individual robes. There's still orgy areas. The only thing is now, you know, you mentioned the nice videos. We didn't have those back in the 70s where you have the porno videos that kind of get things going. But other than that kind of thing, is you still have the steam room, the saunas, the hallways, the sitting rooms, and the orgy areas. It really hasn't changed.
Yeah, they found the formula and they stuck with it. I mean, it works. Yes.
I'm about your age, Papa Tony, and it just made me think, you know, we tend to think of the whole gay fetish kink thing, like 68, late 60s is the beginning of the history. But you know, there's a whole, and maybe we're skewed because of our own personal experience. It's like, I was just thinking, you know, we need to speak with like the 80-year-olds, the 90-year-olds, that there's like a whole history there, even
yep.
going way back.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm talking way back, pre-World War II. You know, because like when you see the celluloid closet, it makes you think there was stuff there going on that nobody was writing about, that nobody was recording, and all that history is just gone.
Yep.
Because we didn't invent kink in the 1960s, I'm guessing.
Somebody had their hand up over here.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking about what else we need to do. Yeah, that question is that we're in a little part of the world, you know, in the United States, and yet the thing is the whole world. That's what I'm looking at. I look at the whole world, and when other people in other countries get to express themselves and their sexuality as they feel, like we're getting to places now, like people are like, okay, I'm questioning, what was that latest one, hetero open or something like that, or
right.
hetero flexible.
Yes.
So there's all kinds of various, people aren't just like, just get away from any kind of labeling and let people just
yeah.
do sexuality on any way that
oh,
they
yeah.
want.
Oh.
And it's still for the whole planet, for all people everywhere.
That's coming.
And
it
if
is
you go
coming.
Back the other way, that's the thing. And we have to remember mm-hmm. that history can go a lot of different ways.
The
so
only way
like,
that it can really go back is if the internet goes away. Because
right.
the internet is where we're getting the real information. If you go online and you say, wait a second, I'm not the only one that's into toe sucking. Wow, I thought I was a freak, and turns out there's 5,000 guys on this website. Or whatever. There's that's the thing, is that people are no longer feeling like they're the pink ape in a cage full of brown apes. They're feeling like, hey, this is it. This is who I am. I'm not going to apologize for it anymore. And that's where we've been leading the way. I mean, I speak as a very... He's going to be next to you. I speak as somebody who is very ballsy. I scared the shit out of the older gay leathermen because I was ballsy. Why? Because I was not going to fucking apologize for my existence to anybody. I was going to tell my truth whether they liked it or not. I called myself a pie-in-the-face homosexual because I came out to everybody. Without fail, everybody. And the common question people ask is, how the hell did you spend the last, you know, 2.5 years of the time that you were in the Navy being openly gay? Didn't they go after you? They tried once. I was a really good sailor. I had very high marks. But suddenly, I started getting bad marks. And they started, you know, the guys in charge of my division were starting to make rumbling noises about, you know, we've got a problem with you. And I said, okay, hang on, I can fix this right now. I said, if you want your faces to be on the cover of the Gay and Lesbian Times, keep going. I'll talk to you guys in a little bit. And I left, and they came back to me later and said, never mind. Because, man, there was no fucking way I was going to let them do anything. The only other bad thing that happened to me at all during that time I was openly gay in the Navy is we were out at sea, and the ship was going back and forth, and we're down in the dining area, and I'm sitting on one of the tables watching a movie. We're playing a movie on the TV. And suddenly I felt something hot on my ass. And I reached down, found a lit cigarette. Somebody had rolled it against my ass. I looked around, and all the men were looking up this way and that way, like, oh, not me. And I stubbed it out, and I went back to watching the movie. Didn't make a fuss, didn't get all victimized. I was cool about it. That was it. Nobody dared do anything else. However, this is a very important story that I did last night and I forgot to tell. This is very true about what life is like for males. Okay, remember I said when you've been out at sea for 3 months, there are no heterosexual males. Well, there were these two master chiefs in my division. You know how like in the dress blues where each gold slash on the sleeve represents 4 years they've been in the Navy. Well, both of them had sleeves full of these gold slashes. They always were around each other. Oh, they were, you know, wrinkled old, super tanned old guys covered in tattoos and scars. They were always brawling in bars and shit, and they were, you know, just real raunchy type guys, and they had nothing nice to say to the gay guy. They were always trying to get my goat, and I didn't care. They had no effect on me at all. I thought it was funny. It really did. They did not make me sad at all, I promise you, my brothers. And they would just say shit to try and get my goat. Well, my gift is that someone will say something like that, I can bounce it back at them as if my favorite friend just made a wonderful joke, and I'll come back with an even better joke. And it just totally fucked them up. They didn't know what to do with it. You know, they had no comeback for it, and they got very frustrated. Well, so then we went overseas, and when we pulled into Subic Bay, over the town around the bar, around the base was called Olongapo, full of bars. Well, our division's bar, there were 60 guys in my division, and our bar was the happy bar. It was full of Filipina prostitutes, and they were all hoping that some stupid young heterosexual male would have sex with them, fall in love with them, marry them, and get the fuck out of Olongapo, and get them over to the big PX in America. That's how a lot of Filipinas got here. Well, so I wasn't interested in that, and I certainly wasn't looking for Benny Boys, which was the name for drag queens. So I spent a lot of time having sex on the gym, on the base. But I showed up at the happy bar, because that's where my coworkers were. The first time I walk in the door, and I see all of them standing in a circle and chanting, 47, 48, 49, 50. I'm looking, and here's these two master chiefs on the ground with their pants around each other, deep-throating each other, and everybody's counting to see how many seconds they can keep go without coming up for air. Something doesn't compute here. You know, I was still pretty innocent back then. And later on that evening, I'd see him sitting there in the booth, two of them sitting next to each other across from some guy with his whore, and they'd be drunk out of their skulls. They always got drunk, and they'd be jacking each other off. You know, and I'd be, okay. And I asked the other guys, what the hell? Oh, it's just what they do. Okay. So then when we get back to the States, one of them was giving me some shit, trying to get my goat. I just laughing at him, and I said, you know, it's been proven that those guys who have the most trouble with homosexuality are the ones who struggle the most with it themselves. Oh, not me, not this guy, I'm 100%. I said, dude, what about Olongapo? He says, that's different. That's on the other side of the international date line. Yeah. Sorry, I had to share that story. That was part of last night, and I forgot to include it. So who was next? Somebody, I said somebody they were next. Oh, Tommy, I'm sorry, I've been ignoring you.
I don't know, it was just 5 minutes ago, somebody was talking about when the leather community started getting coming out to the country, I think it was you. I've done my fair share of like puppy play, trying to do some research on it. The earliest I could find was in the straight community in the 1930s.
Huh.
The gay community, we adopted it in World War II from the Nazis. But the Nazis adopted it from the Greeks and the Romans back in medieval times.
Why?
If you
leather?
Not puppy play. What I'm talking about with the Nazis was, and the Romans and Greeks, is just straight up BDSM.
Got it.
The Romans, with the military, if you disobeyed a direct order, you would get flogged for 2 days straight. And so it slowly made it up to its way to the UK, and then they discovered about the endorphin rushes and that people enjoyed it. And the Nazis loved it because it was a good way to keep the soldiers happy and keep them in line. When we went over there and bombed the hell out of them and invaded them, we just started, all the male soldiers started to see it and started to pick it up and then adopted the traits.
Cool. Thank you. Who was next?
That was great.
Somebody over there.
I forgot.
Oh. How about, go ahead, David. When you get it, just let me know. David. You were going to say
No, I was just high on it.
Oh.
All right, and the other thing, if you ever noticed the reason a lot of the main leather outfit, have you ever looked at the main leather outfit and then looked at a German officer's outfit?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Let's face it, those bitches knew how to dress.
Yeah. They look almost identical.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, Tom of Finland, I mean, he was very much caught up in, you know, he was part of, you know, an occupied terror. I could be wrong, but I recall in this history somewhere that he was part of, when in World War II, he was really fixated upon these sexy-ass German soldiers. So, you know, it informed his tastes. Yes?
And, well, one note on that is, you don't really see it so much down here, but if you do go to L.A. and you go to a leather event, a lot of times you'll see a lot of guys in very authentic looking leather, I don't know, Nazis or
whatever.
The leather, it's not a leather motorcycle jacket, it's a leather, you know.
Yeah, they've been
saying, and I mean, I've seen them and I, you know, it was like, whoa, okay, where am I at, you know? And I mean, they don't so much have like the Nazi insignias or anything like that, so, but it's the uniform itself, and it's kind of amazing to look at. I mean, I know I've done a lot of staring at them, like, wow, that's hot.
Yeah.
So
I think the biggest part of why we adopted so much of that is because it's intimidating. It's controversial, and it makes you look like, ooh, I don't want to mess with that guy.
Yeah.
And so I think that's why. Well, and plus it just looks damn good. So much of it just really looks really hot. And I think that was a big part of it. Is it kind of lets you play the role of the asshole or the bad guy.
Yeah.
It's a hyper-masculine look.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, it's well past 9 o'clock. I guess, I thank you, gentlemen.
There's information about Romp and some other events up on the board there, so make sure you check
it
out.
Is anybody not on the email list or the Facebook page? Raise your hand if you're not. Okay, so let's get you on there. I'll make sure of that. Just a couple of quick announcements. First of all, let us thank Slave Keith. Our group now has access to a tall sling frame. It is 6'6". Why would we care about a tall sling frame? It's great for suspension play. It's great because we can have it in the center of the room and have 4 flogging stations, one on each side. And it's stable. It's got attachments for restraints at the top, you know, so it's very... So, yes, it's going to be getting some good use. Also... lots of stuff coming up. I'll be doing the newsletter in the morning. I'll be putting it out on the Facebook page and on, you know, the email list and on the website. The next one of these talks where I'm going to be talking about the other part of it, how it was in the early 80s when things went wrong, I'll be doing that this next Tuesday. That's an RSVP-only event. And interestingly, I've had no RSVPs so far whatsoever. I think people are kind of scared of it. It's okay. But I am going to do the talk. I need to tell this story and get it over with because I've been running away from it for a long time. You know, I've been telling a lot of happy, happy, jokey, jokey, aren't I clever, you know, type stories, and they're really good ones, I promise. But there's also a side that I've been running and terrified from, and I need to let it out. So however that happens, I'll be recording it, and I'll be posting it online. Let me see what else. Also, I have announced this before. I'm going to announce it again. Tuesday nights is where the tops come to play. This is a mentoring space. It is a private invitation thing. You want to be a part of it, just come up and ask nicely. We're not being exclusive. We just want to have it be a small number of guys that are really eager to learn how to get to their next phase, their next step as tops. They want to learn more technique, but also how to be good at it, how to be popular at it, where everybody goes, yay, he's here. There's nobody that wants to be a bad top. Everybody wants to believe that they're on the side of the angels. The problem is that there's not enough mentors. And so that's what this is about. We mentor each other. We support each other in becoming better at the things that we do. We try different stuff, and we succeed at it, and everybody comes home very happy. Is there something that you would like to share about last night?
I had a wonderful time. I was fortunate enough to go and be able to, as I said earlier when we were talking about our kink, I really love to play with pain and the power differential during sex, and I was able to really play with that last night with a bunch of really good tops, and it was nice to be the bottom in that role, but to be respected as an equal in that role, rather than being seen as lesser than, because I was in the bottom position. I like the top too, but when it comes to the pain play, I'm really a bottom for that. And it's nice to be accepted for that and to be cherished for that, instead of being thought of, you know, or you're just one of, you know, 100 boys here or whatever, you're, you know, San Diego's bottom heavy or whatever. So it was nice to be respected in that space and to be able to share and experience all of those different techniques and tops and how it's different. So it was really fun. I had a really great time.
Plus, he has a really good body language when you're hitting.
Oh, he's fun. Oh, yeah. Yeah, there was...
He reacts just right.
Yeah, the rest of us were visibly reacting nicely, too. So, any other announcements, anything at all, gentlemen?
Some? Next Wednesday, same place, same bat channel.
What's the topic?
What's happening next Wednesday?
Your meeting?
Yeah.
I'm trying to get out of it because I can't remember the topic.
Oh.
It'll be in the newsletter, right?
They'll send it out on Facebook tomorrow.
We have to go back and look at the list.
I'm with you.
Wonderful. Well, this was fun for me. I hope it was for you too, guys. Thank you for letting me share.
There's more. We need more.
Well, I will be doing more. I don't know if I'll be doing it here, but I will be doing it on an ongoing basis because, like I said, there's a lot of stuff that needs to... There's a lot of stuff I need to lay to rest, you know, and just be complete with and post it online and have it be part of the public record so I'm not dragging around behind me, you know, because it can be a little burdensome, some of the memories that I've got. So, you know, I if I'm going to move into my next phase, I want to have a clean break, you know.
We wanted that second part to be something that was optional, where everybody had a choice to go specifically out and listen to it. And because it's potentially very moving or emotional for a lot of people, it's something you can listen to in your own home and digest in the bites that in which you can digest it, because you know some of what he's going to get into is pretty heavy and you know dark. That's the reason why I encourage as many people as possible who can you know either show up for it. To either to support him, or if you can't do that, I at least encourage everybody to try and listen to it, because it's really important that we hear what he has to say. He's got a lot of good things to tell us about. So,
and from my perspective, what I want to add to that is that what I'm going to be talking about is we are wounded as a tribe, and I'm willing to say it, and I have no shame about saying it, that we've lost so much, and it's going to take generations still for us to recover from it fully. The reason why this group exists is to heal our tribe, where we have each other again, where we find each other in the darkness, and we start gathering again. It's gathering the tribe, because we lost so much, and when so many men died, we lost so much of our history, you know. And the example that I give is in Africa. Poachers always try and kill off the oldest elephants because they got the best tusks. But then the elephants lose their tribal memory, so that when there's a drought, they all die instead of having that 60-year-old matriarch who remembers what they did in the last drought 43 years before to guide them to safety. And that has had a big effect upon our community. And I'll be talking about how things really went bad as a community during the really bad years and then afterwards. So, you know, it's going to be kind of a downer, and there is that. But it's our history, and it's time that we really said it, and I don't know anybody else that could say it in quite the way that I can. Because I was there, and I was... Like, for instance, The Normal Heart recently came out as an HBO TV movie. I own it, but I can't watch it. It's too real for me. I was there, you know, I was in the midst of all that. And so I'll finally be talking about it, because it does need to be said. We don't have enough elders that are willing to share. I mean, it's PTSD in a big way, guys. And it's sad and it's dreary, but too many men are going to go to their graves never telling their story. And I don't want to be one of those guys. I want to have it be there. I want to tell it perfectly. I want to have it be complete and then let go. Because it has been something that I've really struggled with for decades. It causes me to erupt in weird ways that nobody expects. It causes me to stay stuck. And I don't want to be stuck anymore. I want to shift into my next phase. Those of you have already heard me talk. I'm now an elder in the community. I'm bringing back the concept that it's okay to be an elder in our community, because too many men are in Peter Pan mode. You see those guys where... You know, they've got the perfectly black hair and perfectly black beard with white roots, because they're trying to pretend they're still young and vibrant instead of owning their age. And we don't have enough men who own their age and say, it's okay to be this age, I like it, there's benefits. I need to, the work that I'm going towards, the reason why I'm telling these stories, is I'm saying it's okay to be historical and to be loved for it. And that we've earned the miles on our odometer so that these young men can aspire to be us someday and say, you know, he's being treated well when he's older. I guess I've got a future too. So it's all part of that, so that whole thing. So yes, there's always an agenda, but the agenda is bringing more healing to our tribe so that we can depend on each other. And we don't have to worry that things are going to go so bad that we'll never be able to come back together again. Because for a long time, we couldn't come back together again. So I'll be talking about that. So it'll be in the newsletter. I'm going to get you on the list. Thank you, gentlemen. Any other announcements at all?
Yeah, yes. This just did pop up on a Disney studio, this space by here. And
yes.
It doesn't charge us any rent. So if somebody can volunteer on that.
Oh, we did that.
Where was I?
Okay, let's pass it around again, Slade. Here's the hat. Okay, here's the hat. Okay, here's the hat. All right, shaking it. Now, you don't have to donate. It's entirely optional. That's right.
I had no idea.
Well, how about this? We'll pause it. We'll have a tradition that everybody stuff their money into a Slave Kiss G-string.
Right. It's funny.
Very good. Thank you. No expectations. All right. I need your email. Oh, okay. I'm going to stop this thing.
Want water?
Yes, please. Yes, indeed.